Melanie Haller was a beautiful girl with a beautiful body. She's an actress. She got to work with the greatest actor, John Travolta.
For Melanie, Playboy was the next step. This was, look at me, I'm glamorous, I'm sexy.
Unfortunately, what Melanie couldn't see at the time is that this would have tragic consequences.
There were a lot of darker things going on at the Playboy Mansion, things being videotaped, sexual boundaries being pushed.
He was a hedonist on steroids, and anything that would satisfy his lust or his appetite at the moment was fair game.
What happened in the 80s, if it happened today, people would be in jail. I just don't know why no one warned her.
Welcome back to another edition of Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streaming sphere. And the title of the documentary for this episode is Horrors in the Hamptons. Actress Melanie Haller was poised for stardom after appearing in the television series Welcome Back, Carter, and a pictorial in the March 1980 edition of Playboy. Eager for her next role, she heads to a party in the Hamptons that takes a violent turn. This is going to be season 2, episode 4 of the Playboy Murders. Let's talk through it. Okay, we start out April 14, 1980 in Southampton, New York. And we get the standard overview, scene shots of the area. And let me tell you this. I've been to New York probably 4 or 5 times, right? And just like a lot of places where you know the big city, you know New York, you know LA, you know Denver, but every state has a country part, like the part you never see, the beautiful, slow towns. And when I was in New York, I was working in Brooklyn. I was working in the Bronx. But one of my assignments took me to New Rochelle. It took me to Mount Vernon. And I was like, wow, these places are nice. Same thing with California. I was working in L.A., working in Oakland, working in San Francisco, Sacramento. But also I had assignments in Oakhurst. I had assignments in like Mercer, these little small towns. And it's like, man, I could live here, you know? So that's what we are seeing here. And so this is Southampton. We hear this lady, Megan, talking, and she's saying on April 13th, 1980. And we see, as she's talking, we see this guy walking in this kind of like this blurry, like they want to keep us on our toes, this blurry shot. We hear a man come across the PA system saying, this is a New York City bound train. This station, Southampton. So this is a train PA, and the train is commuting from Southampton all the way back to New York. And this is Megan Stax. Megan Stax has been a staple in these episodes. She's a podcast host of Women in Crime, and she's also a criminologist. So Megan Stax, you can look up her podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember my last episode, I mentioned that I'm starting to see a lot of podcast hosts on some of these like these docu-series and documentaries about crime. So that's who we're hearing from, Megan Stax. So this conductor is walking through the train, you know, to click the, you know, to view the tickets and do the punch, you know, punch the tickets. But he comes across a woman laying on the floor. Her clothes are torn. Her makeup is smeared. And she had bite marks in her neck. And so this conductor also finds a portfolio next to her with pictures in it. And the pictures were of a feature of a spread in Playboy. And he notices, this is kind of weird. He notices that the woman in the pictures, in these Playboy pictures, is the same woman laying on the ground. So that means he took the time to look at these pictures close enough to realize that it's the same woman. Okay. All right. I mean, would you even know if you came across someone like presumably dead, would you notice anything around her unless it's like blood or like a, you know, like a murder weapon or a weapon that could be construed as a murder weapon? would you notice pictures? I don't know. Maybe it wasn't like immediately. Maybe, you know, as he was like trying to figure out shit, he was like, oh, that's the same chick that's laying on the ground. So anyway, he notices this. And what's funny is there was another episode where the cops came in and noticed torn pictures all on the floor. Anyway, so the victim was 22-year-old Melanie Haller. Okay, so she pronounced it as Haller, but it's spelled H-A-L-L-E-R, Melanie Haller. So Megan Staggs pronounced it as Haller. I'm going to pronounce it as Haller. And we see depictions of this. And you guys know how it goes. So we start out with the crime. We do the old Columbo. We start out with the crime. And then now we're going to, you know, figure out what happened. So we see these pictures of Melanie Haller. Melanie Haller. So she's standing here. She has on like a leather jacket with a red jumpsuit under it. Like, you know, like the snap crotch jumpsuit with some jeans on, and she's looking like a badass. She's looking like one of the Charlie's Angels. So Melanie Haller appeared. We hear from Holly Madison. Melanie Haller appeared in the March 1980 issue of Playboy. This was the issue. So she's not the cover shot. The cover picture of this March 1980 edition is Bo Derek. Man, oh man. I don't think there's a boy that born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s. I don't think there's a boy on the planet who doesn't know who Bo Derek is. Remember 10? So it says, I'm looking at the Playboy cover. It says, Bo Derek, the 10 girl in a sensational new pictorial. I think Bo Derek was my first white girl crush. Probably a lot of black dudes' first white girl crush, right? And then Brooke Shields was right after that. I'm just going to go out and say that. Holy shit, I went on a tangent. I forgot who's the episode about. Melanie Haller. Okay, let's get back to Melanie Haller. I'm going to have to do a lot of editing. All right, so Bo Derek is on the cover of this March 1980 edition Melanie Haller was in. And we see all these other actresses that's posing in this same edition, man. Oh, Brooke Shields was in Playboy also. Brooke Shields, Goldie Hawn. And they're just going over, you know, these issues in the 1980s. So Brooke Shields came out in the Christmas issue. Goldie Hawn came out in the 1985 issue. So you're getting these really big names in Playboy. Holly Madison is just going over and saying like how huge Playboy was in the 70s and the early 80s. It was just a staple in American culture. And we know that by now. And Stella Tenenbaum is back in it again. Stella Tenenbaum is a staple in these series, you know, because she was the inside person, her and her husband. They were on the inside. And I'm just saying that if this is your first episode listening to, if you don't know by now, Stella Tenenbaum and her husband, blah, blah, some Tenenbaum, they were both employees of Playboy. And so they got all the inside dirt. I didn't realize she was on the hostess for 2 years, 1978 to 1980. I thought she was a hostess for way longer than that. But yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know why they do this every episode. Like at a point when you're on season two, you should assume the audience know certain things because they burn up a lot of time in these episodes with repeat information. Like talking about how big and what a media empire Playboy was. Yeah, no shit. It was a media empire. So I don't know why they have to burn up time with this stuff. Like they should have saved something new for every episode outside of the case. And maybe they're going to get to it later. And maybe I'm just rambling too early. All right. Okay. So Tenenbaum, she's saying marriage was out of vogue. This was the Saturday Night Fever era, the disco era. This was the Let Your Freak Flag Fly era. It was just kind of like right after Woodstock era. And we see the scene in Saturday Night Fever where the crowd was doing the John Travolta, you know, the dance. Yeah, they're doing the, I don't know what the hell the dance is called. But we see outside of the original Playboy mansion in Chicago, but in the early 70s, Hef bought a property. That's when he bought the LA property and he called it Playboy Mansion West. I think we heard that in season one, right? So, and that turned into his home. That so that second location in L.A. became his home. That's where everything went down. That's when all the legendary parties went down. All the freakness went down.
All the things that would become legendary about the Playboy world.
This was a house when I first got it that sort of turned out to be a blessing because we were able to do something kind of special.
The Playboy Mansion was a really beautiful building. It was on several acres of just beautiful grounds, and it just really felt like an escape. You could hold these really lavish parties indoors, in the backyard. It became a really popular place for celebrities to just go and, you know, party, and nobody was going to ask any questions because they felt like they could indulge themselves and it would be private and secret and just an appropriate place for them to let loose.
So we hear from Gina Keough. Her playmate name, Gina, and it's Gina spelled J-E-A-N-A, right? So her name is Gina Keough, but I guess I didn't realize this. They had playmate names. Her playmate name was Gina Tomosimo. And she was Playmate of the Month for November 1980. I guess I didn't realize some of them didn't use their real name. I mean, I know like the girl with the star tattoo. I can't fucking remember her name. Something Star. I mean, that's obvious. She's just saying how like, you know, women went to California to be actresses, to be stars, to be celebrities. And Playboy was a stepping stone for that. And we know that. We've heard that in previous episodes. So Playboy was like the get through. You know what I mean? Like the shoe with the foot in. You get in it, you get into Playboy, and you know, it's going to launch some sort of career. So I'm looking at Gina Tomosino. So she was already in Chicago when Playboy discovered her. Her modeling agency's building, it was the Playboy building. So she would just be walking in and, you know, somebody from Playboy would see her in the elevator and she would be like, no, I don't want to do Playboy. So she figured she wanted to be a part of the sorority. She wanted to get jumped in and be a part of the gang. So she said it brought her opportunities that she would never have had if she hadn't done Playboy. So she met Melanie. She said she was a beautiful girl, and Melanie was already a working actress. Okay, so if you're already a working actress and Playboy is a stepping stone to you know, stardom, why would you be acting, be already an actress, and then go to Playboy? It seemed like a downgrade. It seemed like Playboy would be for somebody who fell off, right? And that's exactly what she's saying. She's saying she already had talent. She don't know if Playboy would be an extra boost or what, but she already had talent. So Melanie was already, you know, doing stuff. So Melanie was born in 1959 in New York City. And she already grew up around like the arts and stuff like that. So that's where she got her passion for acting. She got a small role in The French Connection. And I'm trying to see where she is in The French. Okay, so she was only like 12 years old when she was in The French Connection. So she got to work with Gene Hackman in The French Connection. So we sing the opening scene to Welcome Back, Carter. So Welcome Back, Carter, for you youngsters, was like the 70s version of Head of the Class, if I remember correctly. Melanie Holler played Angie Gabowski. She was the chick they all went crazy for. But she don't look anything like her Playboy pictures. First of all, on the show, her hair was like a straight blonde. But in the Playboy pictures they showed, her hair was like short and dark. And Holly Madison is saying like being on Welcome Back, Carter back then was like being on Game of Thrones now. Because, I mean, you know, you only had three channels and everybody watched the same thing. Man, I kind of miss those days where it was like you either watch this, this, or this. That's it. And then you got to school the next day and everybody was talking about the same shit. You know what I mean? Like, but now there's so much stuff. Let me name all the streaming services I have. Disney Plus, Hulu, Netflix, Peacock, Paramount Plus, Max. And then the free ones that I watch often, especially when I'm in the hotel when I don't want to sign in to my paid accounts. You got Tubi, you got Pluto, and then you got all the other. I don't have Apple TV yet. But I do have YouTube Premium. I don't think I've ever watched anything but documentaries on YouTube Premium. But it's just so much, man. It's so much. Let alone like the movies, going to the movie theater. It's so much. Man, when I was growing up, you went to the movie theater like once a year. That was it. You would, like, once a year. So that's pretty much what Holly Madison is talking about. Like, Welcome Back Carter was popular. John Travolta was in that. And matter of fact, his little sidekick was also in Staying Alive or Saturday Night Fever. The little guy with the curly hair. So when Welcome Back Carter came to an end, Melanie Holler got a role in a movie about the Hillside Strangler. And she started to rise as a star. So somebody brought up to the Playboy Mansion and wants help. You know, if he sees somebody he wanted to, you know, throw his old meat in. They showed an earlier, younger Heff. Heff has always looked old. Heff is like the white Morgan Freeman. He's never not looked old. And he's never not looked like a... man, money make people handsome when you're a guy. When you're a guy, if you got money or you got charisma or you can make chicks laugh, panties are dropping. And I don't know if Heff had... Well, I guess he had to have charisma. But I don't know if he had jokes, but he definitely had money. And he was just, you know... If he sees something he wanted, he will just point at it. And we see him standing with Melanie Holler and there's some other chick on the left of him. So that was her being discovered by Playboy when she went to that party. And now she was the girl. So Holly Madison is saying there was kind of two types of models that went into Playboy. That was the new undiscovered talent, usually like the Playboy of the month, the Playmate of the month or the centerfold. And as she's saying, as we see, you know, we are seeing examples of this, of these like unknown, these new discovered, like they're not celebrities already. But then you also have the celebrities. Kim Basinger, we see this cover girl, Kim Basinger. But are they on top? Like if they're a celebrity, aren't they falling off? Like they're not like at the top of their game and doing Playboy, right? It's like after they start to fall off, you know, these celebrities that do Playboy. So, but Melanie was an established actress already when she did her Playboy shoot. And Holly just saying, like, the reason actresses would decide to do Playboy is it would get them a lot of attention. But if you remember from previous episode, it was also a gift and a curse. Like, once you did Playboy, it was like, you know, a lot of people were like, you know, hands off. But Holly is saying that in Melanie's case, it's the getting out of the being seen as a teenager type thing. Like she wanted to be seen in a new light. She wanted to be seen as an adult. And we've heard that before. So the title of her spread was a take on Welcome Back Carter. It was Welcome Back Holler. And that was the spread that I described earlier where she had on a leather jacket. Pretty much she was dressed as like a female version of the John Travolta character in Welcome Back Carter. So from all accounts, her pictorial in Playboy was more special than just being Playmate of the Month because people recognize her from TV in her acting roles. And like I said, man, they keep showing the same picture. It's the one that I said she looks like a like one of these Charlie's Angels. She got on the leather jacket. She got the red top on. And she got this big, thick black belt and then some jeans. And she's standing in front of like a classic car. I can't tell exactly what car this is, but, you know, she's standing in front of a classic car. And then you open the pages of that pictorial and then you see her backstage with her, you know, titties hanging out. She's standing in front of a mirror in like a dressing room getting ready. But she got them mamas out. So it's pretty much she's graduated. She's no longer, you know, seen as that little innocent teeny bopper or whatever. She's at the next level. So Holly is saying, according to people who was with Heff in the early 1970s and the 1980s, there was a lot of darker things going on. And what does that mean? So she's explaining what those darker things are.
Like things being videotaped and just like sexual boundaries being pushed. What seems to be a common theme in that era?
Everyone was doing drugs, and it was just this whole era of promiscuous behavior. And it was expected of you if you were at the mansion. If you went there, you were going to have to party and party hard. And it was a mandatory part of the job.
Melanie spent a few weeks at the mansion, but I don't think that this lifestyle was really for Melanie. The Playboy lifestyle was one at the time of parties, wild parties. And these were drug-fueled parties, and there was a lot of sex going on.
What happened in the 80s, if it happened today, those people would be in jail.
Listen, make no mistake about it. When they say party and when women involved, when they say partying, they mean sexual or fucking assault. That's what they mean. I mean, and that's why I wanted to make that an audio clip so it wouldn't be from. You heard her. She said, like, if that went on today, a lot of people would be in jail. That's what that means. When they say partying and drugs and it was mandatory, that means you had no say so. Once you step in, and it's probably like that now, but the only difference is there's probably documents involved, like what's they call NDAs or whatever the fuck perverts and pedophiles try to do legally to make it where women can't talk about whatever the fuck happened to them when they say no. So that's what they're describing that went down. And I don't know, man. I guess if you're naive, you weren't expecting this type of thing. So, and we keep hearing, what's her name that changed her name to Tomasino or something like that? She's saying people didn't put up, even then people wouldn't sort of put up with it, but there was consequences for not doing the thing that's mandatory. So she's saying she was sitting at the table with six girls, right? And one of the girls say, hey, I don't want to sleep with Hef. And then she asked the question. She's posing the question to the table. If I don't sleep with Hugh Hefner, is there any chance of me becoming a centerfold? And then naively answering that question, she says, yeah, sure. Just tell him you got a boyfriend. Just tell him you engaged or whatever. He sleeps with like 11 other girls. Like, you know, he wouldn't even think about you because he's sleeping with so many of these trollops. He wouldn't even notice that he didn't sleep with you. So a few minutes later, Gina comes in, and then Gina walks in and said, Mr. Hefner would like to see you. And they're like, what? So Gina goes up. Hefner is sitting in his bed. He sort of like pets the bed like, you know, come here. Come sit down. Come sit right here. Like what you do to your dog. You know, matter of fact, I just did it to my dog probably an hour ago when I wanted him, my youngest dog, Astro. I wanted him to calm down. So I just pet the bed. I'm like, dude, chill out, man. It's midnight. Come settle. So I pet the bed. And that's what Hugh Hefner did to her, like a puppy. Come sit down right next to me. Right. So she goes, she sits down, and he plays a recording for her.
Engaged her. You don't have to sleep with him. He sleeps with 11 other girls.
He had, before any of us even knew what it was, he had microphones in the dining room. He could hear everything we were saying. So he's like, don't you ever tell a girl that she doesn't have to sleep with me because she has no chance of being in the magazine if she doesn't.
And at that time, Hefner and his people would say, oh no, she's here because she wants me.
Look, I don't have any sons. I have only daughters. And I always tell them, don't let nobody pay for your shit because there's expectations. Nobody has to buy you anything outside of our house. And that's why I tell them that. Because this world would have you believe just because of laws and what's common sense, then no boundaries can be broken. So let me get this right. You think you're going to go to this pervert's house, this dude, the only thing he got going for him is what he can do for you. You think he's not going to want some? What do you have to offer him besides your body? What do you think he's going to want besides your body? I mean, it's so unfortunate that people are so naive. They think you're going to go to this man's house, to this man's mansion, and live off him. Do you think you can be a centerfold without sleeping with Hef? Now we're seeing reenactment of what I'm thinking is her getting dicked down by Hef. And Tenenbaum is saying, hey, that was the motive. That was the MO. That's how they live. You know, that was par for the course. Like, if you're going to get somewhere in Hef's world, you got to get digged down by Hef. You got to follow those red line rules, man. And as poised as these, like Holly Madison and these other women are who's, being interviewed, they've been digged down by Hef. So they can act, you know, Holly Madison, you know, she's like all poised and cool and seems so educated. But, you know, they've all been dicked down by health. And they got whatever claim to fame they got by being dicked down by health. And I'm not even, like I'm saying, if he put those rules out there, like if he said, hey, if you want to get four, you got to bend over. And they agree to that. That's consenting adults. So Gina is, she's saying now that, like, you know, you can't stay at the mansion forever. Because one thing, age, you start aging day by day, and there's always new bitches that want health. So there's only so many rooms, there's only so many accommodations. So Melanie stayed for a few weeks, did whatever she had to do PR-wise, and went home back to mom. So she went back to live with her mom in New York City. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, we don't know yet, Megan Stacks is saying this move would have tragic consequences. And we see this reenactment of this lady being, I don't know, she looked drugged and somebody's dragging her out. So wait a minute. So I'm confused. I'm confused as to why she would have tragic consequences. So maybe she didn't get digged down by health. So we heard from this guy named Dennis McDougal. And Dennis McDougal was a reporter for a former LA Times journalist. So his beat was the darker side of the Hollywood business. So he said Melanie had the looks and the skills to become a star. She was well on her way to becoming that star. So shortly after Melanie gets back to New York, she was introduced to this guy named Roy Radin by a photographer friend. And the guy who recommended her to this photographer was named Ron Sisman. So Roy Radin was like a Hollywood showbiz producer. So he was pretty much trying to hook her up with industry bigwigs who could propel her towards the stardom that she was looking for. So we meet this other guy. His name is Anthony Hayden Guest. So he's describing Roy Radin. Roy Radin was a fellow from a showbiz family. He specialized in a fairly defunct form of vaudeville. All right, so he specialized in old circus shit, like the bearded lady and like stuff you would see in old-time Ripley's Believe It or Not type shit. You know what I mean? So this guy wasn't real for real. But evidently he was doing very well with this scam he had going on. So Roy Radin fancied himself as the modern-day P.T. Barnum. Just like I said, some of the stuff that he put on was animal and human oddities. But, I mean, this shit made him the bag. People were still into this stuff. So Roy Radin's father was Alexander Radin, known as Broadway Al. He made his fortune by owning clubs in Manhattan from the 1930s to the 50s. And they were well-known fancy clubs. So this family was a big deal. And they keep showing this dude, man. And he looks like the fucking bearded lady. If you ever seen pictures of, like, the traditional bearded lady, that's what he looks like. He looks like the bearded lady. I'm not even joking. He's like the bearded lady wearing this, like, top hat. So this dude, evidently, the bearded lady guy, he had this big mansion at the end of Long Island. Like, that's how much money he was banking, that he had this gigantic mansion. And we see it. It looks like a manor. It looks like a manor you would see in a horror movie. And they call this mansion Ocean Castle. And Holly is saying the East Coast version of these Hollywood mansions would be in the Hamptons. So this Roy Radin was trying to turn his East Coast Ocean Castle into the equivalent East Coast version of the Playboy Mansion. So Playboy Mansion East is what he was trying to turn this into. So we see this guy named Bob McKeague. And this is who Melanie was dating. And this dude looked like an IRS auditor. I swear to God, man, I'm telling you. So there's this joke that I listened to this podcast called A Date with Dateline. It's with Kimberly and Katie. And they say, so I can, it's, I'm roughly quoting what they say. It's like, give me the confidence of an average white man. The amount of, I'm not above stating when a guy is handsome. Because, if a guy's handsome, he's fucking handsome. But the amount of time I see in these Playboy murder episodes, when these women, it's like, you know this dude got to have money. Because there's no fucking way on earth, if this was the equivalent female, that a guy, a young stud, would be, all right, whatever. So Bob McGee, Mick Keeg, is who she's dating. He has on what we call BCGs. He has on BCGs, and he, like I said, man, he looked like an IRS auditor. And Stacks, she describes him as a slick business guy, known for loving wild parties. Of course he loves wild parties. So Ocean Castle was like a freak party fest, nonstop, all the time. And the idea was to, quote, network. As we're hearing about this, we see, you know, these bowls of coke where people just stuffing their heads into this, snorting this coke. We see this old fat fuck of guys with these hot-ass young women, you know, standard for this type of setting. And anyone who was connected could get into these parties. And Megan Stacks is saying that it was rumored at these parties there was all sorts of sexual debauchery, psychedelic drugs. And listen, yeah, I'm being opinionative, but these people in this show, they are affirming what I'm saying ahead of time. It's just, it is what it is. So there was all sorts of shit going down. Psychedelic drugs. And Raiden was also known for videotaping these parties. So he was way ahead of his time. R. Kelly and Diddy ain't got shit on this dude. He was already doing this with what was the Betamax and Reel to Reel. So he was videotaping these parties and all these sexual endeavors that were happening. So he had his own casting couch. He's described as the Harvey Weinstein of his era. And it wasn't unusual for people who were involved in the entertainment business and who had like a kinky side to them that they would get their own video cameras out instead of just shooting a like vacation video. They would be shooting all of this debauchery, setting up in these bedrooms in this Ocean Castle and just making their own like porn pretty much. But Raiden, he was such a deviant that he had a lot more disturbing types of videos. He had what's called, that's the word I was trying to think of, snuff video. In the last episode, I couldn't remember what was the name, because there was a movie with Nicolas Cage called 8mm. I couldn't remember the name of what they call these videos, but it was called snuff videos, right? And that was my first time ever. Like, when I went to see that 8mm, I didn't even really know what it was about. I took were we married then? No, we weren't married then. We were just dating, but we were living together. And I remember, there's only two movies that I took my wife to that I regret. One was Event Horizon. And matter of fact, it was a double date, and me and my roommate both regretted taking my now wife and her. It was her roommate that my roommate took. We were in the military. We were all in the military. Me and my best friend in the military were roommates, and my wife and her roommate. That's who we took on dates, and we both regretted. And Event Horizon wasn't even that scary, but oh my God, man, I regret it to this day ever taking her to that. And then the other one was this 8mm. And it was the same situation. It was a double date, but I didn't know shit about snuff film. I didn't know anything about that. I had no idea what it was going to be about. Nicolas Cage was in it. Nicolas Cage was hot at the time. We went to see it, but it was about this snuff shit where they actually fucking like it's like you don't know it at the time, but no, these women are dying in these porn slash caught on camera murder videos. And that's what Megan Stacks is saying, that this dude was into snuff videos. He was making snuff videos. So, and they're describing, which are pornographic videos that feature actual murders. Yeah, so now we're back at April 13, 1980, Southampton, New York. So the plan was for Melanie and her new boyfriend to go out to the Hamptons, spend a weekend at Roy Raiden's place.
Melanie thought this party would be a great networking opportunity, so she brought along a portfolio of some of her work, including her Playboy pictorial.
What she expected was that there'd be some socializing, but it was supposed to be an opportunity for her to show Raiden her portfolio. What Melanie had expected was nothing like what actually happened.
So evidently this Raiden guy, he had money, he had power, he had influence, he had connections. Like, he was the big fucking deal. So when Melanie showed up trying to show her portfolio, they were like, nah, we don't give a shit about none of that. You got to drop them draws. Raiden kept giving her drugs and alcohol and drugs and more alcohol and more drugs. He just wanted to get her out of her mind so he can do whatever the hell he wanted to do to her. Because of all the drugs and shit, she blanked out. And I may play more clips in this episode because it seemed like this episode is the most so far out of season one and the first few of this season seems the most diabolical. I want you to hear the words from these witnesses themselves, these witnesses and these experts. Damn sure more experts as to what goes on in these situations than I do. I want you to hear it from their mouth. So it's not like, because a lot of times I paraphrase, I summarize, but these words they're using, I want you to hear it from the people who were there and from the people who knows what goes on.
Historically, the lines have been very blurred between casting and socializing, and then the casting couch comes into play. And to top it off, you have this situation with someone with very extreme tastes.
At one point, two of the female guests, one of whom was his fiancée, Tony Follette, brought out sexual bondage equipment. I'm not sure how comfortable Melanie was, but her date seemed to be. Bob McKeige tried to tie Melanie up.
Roy liked to film some of his encounters, and at some point with Melanie, he brought his camera out.
And set up a tripod in his bedroom. He was trying to duplicate Hugh Hefner's rumored hobby of capturing everything on videotape.
So at some point, this became too uncomfortable for Melanie. But they describe it as she started to fight back. So she started to resist. So maybe it was when they started to bound her. It was at that point. So not at the point where she saw their tools. It was at the point where they started trying to apply those tools to her that she started to fight back. And during that fight, she accidentally broke the camera. So she knocked off the camera. And we see a reenactment of this camera. It's a gigantic ass RCA video camera. Like the shoulder rigs, the first video cameras that took a full VHS. So dude got mad because she broke his expensive ass equipment. So Raiden, Bob McKeige, and two females began beating Holler. They all start beating her and sexually assaulting Melanie. And Melanie's boyfriend, McKeige, he's a deviant. She broke his fantasy. He was fantasizing of her being bound and just watching whatever they can think of in their mind happening to her. That was now, and them filming it, that was now gone. That fantasy is gone, so now they're angered. They're angered, they're on fucking drugs, they're coked up, they're doped up, they're out of their mind, and now they're just taking all that frustration of that fantasy being broken out on her. So, after they beat the fuck out of her, Bob McKeige and Roy, they call Melanie's mom. And we see this reenactment. The phone's ringing. It's like late at night or early morning. We see a woman getting out of bed, answering the phone. And it's Raiden. He told Myra that Melanie was at his house, completely incoherent, and he had to find a way to get her home. So Myra pleaded with Raiden to send her home in a limo. Raiden said no. He said that the $60 price tag was too high. Now, these supposed to be ballers, man. These supposed to be high rollers. But he's saying the $60 price tag for a limo was too high to send this girl home. So now we see that same video we saw earlier, the same clip of them dragging this woman, no shoes on her feet. She's not standing. She's being dragged forward. She's been dragged forward. So her legs are bent and her toes are dragging on the concrete. And two men are dragging her. And so they dump her on the fucking train. These high rollers, these ballers, they dump her on the fucking public transit. And now we know this is when the, what do they call it? The train, not the conductor, the train guy. This is when he came across her. So we're back at the beginning of the episode. So we meet this guy, Lee Roman. He's a Suffolk County PD, retired. So this is the cop. So he was working in the office in West Hampton, the 7th Squad office. The phone is ringing. And he picks up the call saying that they had a body in Brookhaven Hospital that had been assaulted. And so, okay, so she wasn't dead. She was still alive. So they, you know, when the conductor found her on the train, she ended up getting transported to the emergency room. So when he gets there, it's Melanie Holler. And he describes her as a real wreck, but she was still alive. So the cops are trying to talk to her. She's incoherent. She can barely speak. He's saying her hair was going every which way. She was battered. She was bruised. And as they're trying to talk to her, the nurse comes in and tell them, y'all got to leave. Y'all got to come back. She's in no state to be trying to talk to nobody. So the only thing that she ended up saying is that she was in Roy Radin's house. So she was able to get that out. And they call it the Ocean Castle. So she told him that much. So, and Roy Radin's name was known because he put on shows for law enforcement, the first responders, the New York City Police Department. So they knew who he was. Anybody who was in any of the police departments knew that name. They knew who he was. And if you were a cop, he'll buy you a drink. If you were out at the bar somewhere where he was at, he'll buy you a drink. So he had a good relationship with the cops. He donated large sums of money to the police union. So he was in with the cops. And he played that to his benefit. So the cops go back on Monday to talk to Melanie Holler. Sometimes like early in the morning. And by the time they got back, she was looking better than she was the last time they saw her. And she told them that she was assaulted. And she said she was also raped. So she told the detective that she saw a gun in the bedroom. And that was it. That's what he needed for probable cause. So that gave him the power and the information to get a search warrant, a gun. Not the fact that she said she was fucking raped, assaulted. This was being video recorded without her permission. She didn't agree to none of this shit. None of that fucking mattered. But when she said, I saw a gun. Oh, you saw a gun? Okay. Never mind the drugs and all that other shit. And let me describe this detective, right? You guys know I like to be descriptive about the way about people's appearances to put you in the visual. So this dude is 1,000 years old and he's still sporting a left earring in his ear, a left stud earring in his ear. He's in his early thousands. But to be honest, man, I can tell this dude was a stud in his day. This dude, I can see younger women going for. But Hugh Hefner and these other fucking, nah. So anyway, they got the search warrant. They went up to the house. They didn't have any local police with them because at the time, they knew a lot of the local police were in good with Radin. So, wait a minute. So who are they? Wait. I thought he was local police. Oh, okay. No. Yeah. Okay. So he mean the Hampton police. Okay. So he's New York. All right. So he's in the city and they going out to the Hamptons with the warrant. And he didn't want any of the locals to drop a dime on them coming up there. So they didn't include any of the local Hampton police. And we see an actual police photo, right? It's reminiscent of the Briarhurst Manor. And this guy is describing it as a castle. So it's right on the ocean of Southampton Village. It looks creepy to me, to be honest. It doesn't look inviting. It definitely, so the way they were describing it earlier, like it's this big man, it doesn't look inviting. So they go in, they gather everybody in the living room, and they just start searching all the rooms. So when they saw Roy Radin, he's describing him, he was like, he was in his probably 30s, and he wasn't very tall. Of course he wasn't tall. Of course he was a fucking munchkin. If he didn't have any money or power, nobody would fucking bat an eye at him. Of course, like, Who else would be here? Who else would be doing this kind of shit besides a troll? So he was overweight. He was a little this fat fucking troll of a ogre. And
he was very overweight.
Roy Raiden seems to be in disbelief that Detective Roman would dare enter his premises. He is threatening him with all of the people that he knows and that he knows the sheriff. Once he realizes that Roman is not deterred by his rantings and ravings, he says he's going to call his lawyer. And instead, he starts calling other people that he knows in the police department.
When we were there, he was making phone call after phone call. He was calling everybody. I knew that the people he would call him weren't going to put any pressure on us. I know the sheriff of Suffolk County knew him, didn't want to be rude to him, but he wasn't about to tell us to get out of the house to forget the search.
So he's trying to call in his markers and nobody's biting because they're like, bro, we can't help you against those detectives. So they started to investigate and try to go and find everything that Melanie Howler said that was there. The drugs. And they are like a dog with a bone looking for a bone on this revolver, on this one fucking gun. It's so hard to imagine that the thought of a revolver would garnish this sort of response, especially in today's time. But, you know, I know New York laws, gun laws are more strict than probably a lot more places in the U.S. But look, man, I'm in Colorado. I see guns in Walmart. I see dudes walking around with fucking guns in Walmarts. So the fact that they are making this big stink about a revolver is crazy to me. It's just, it's like they keep talking about this revolver. So they find the drugs in Tony Filet's room, and then they find the gun in Raiden's room. And it's sitting, I'm looking at the actual police footage. It's a revolver, and it's sitting in a holster, a gun holster, next to the gun don't even bother me. The thing next to the gun is what bothers me. It's like a mini bowler whip, but it's next to this revolver. The revolver is in the sheath, and this looked like a cop's revolver. Back in the day when cops used revolvers, that's what this looked like, because it has the metal clamp for to be clipped on a utility belt. So Bob McKeige was there when they got there. So he was fucking still there. And he described him as like he was a very distinguished guy. He was dressed to the nines. He said he don't even know Melanie Howler. Never saw her, never even heard of her. That's what he's telling these detectives. Didn't even know she was there, had nothing to do with her. And remember, this is her boyfriend. So now that they find part of the stuff she told them about, now they go and look for this bedroom with their camera set up. And so now we see police footage of this bedroom. There's like wine on the table. There's like a plate full of drugs on the table. And there's like, I don't see a camera, but there's like this audio visual sort of set. Definitely look high tech for the times. Next to the bed. And it looks like, it doesn't even look like a bed. It looks like a sofa that's pulled out to a bed. So, okay, so now they show the RCA camera with a boom mic, like an old school boom mic extended from it. Man, like, you can tell for the times, this is high-tech, expensive-ass equipment. So they find it, and they took the video camera. And the tape, and it still had the tape inside of it. So they take it as evidence. I mean, that tells you, like, how unafraid these people were, how on top they thought they were, that they didn't try to get rid of none of this shit. They put her on their train, and they thought that was going to be the end of it. So the cops get the videotape, the evidence, and they took it over to the police AV section, audiovisual section, and asked them if they could find anything on it. So they realized right away that the film had been erased. So the AV department of the cops, of the New York cop, they went through the whole tape. And there were two frames that were on the beginning of the tape that were erased. And they found them. So when they erased it, they didn't get the two that were still inside the reel. And we are looking at, I'm not sure if this is a reenactment or this is the actual frames. And it showed McKeige and Melanie Howler on the bed. Well, the only person I see on the bed is Melanie Howard. And she's butt-ass naked on the bed. I don't see McKeige. But the fact that he denied So this must not be the actual footage, because the only person I see on the bed is Howler. But evidently in the real version, it was McKeege and Howler. And the fact that he said he never even knew her, they got him. So that's all they needed. So they arrested Roy Rading. They arrested Tony Follette, the girlfriend, and they arrested Bob McKeege for assault.
The story breaks. It becomes national news. A story like this would attract a lot of attention and intrigue. You have this person who's a successful producer. He's throwing all these mysterious, lavish, exclusive parties. There's all kinds of, you know, scary things going on. So it captures the public's imagination.
Rading consistently denied to the press that he was guilty of a crime. What he said instead was that he and Melanie and his other guests had engaged in consensual sex games. And to explain her injuries, he said that Melanie had sustained a slip and fall on the stairs at the mansion.
So at the time all of this is happening, her issue of Playboy is still on the newsstands and on the magazine racks. So she's all in the headlines. People know who she is. I didn't realize it was this close to when she did her Playboy shoot. So she's still on top. She's still hot. And then the thing about this, man, is that, you know, people are going to be like, how are you going to be hollering rape if you in this magazine showing your titties? So that's exactly what they were thinking. Like, so that kind of played against her for her accusations. It's like if a prostitute says, so actually I had to learn, I learned just watching true crime documentaries. Like if a Trick pay for head, that's all he paid for. Even though she offered like, okay, this amount for head, this amount for this, this amount for that. If he only paid for head and he tried to do something else, that's sexual assault, because he didn't pay for what he's trying to get. I know there's dudes out there that they pay for sex. I've never had to do that. So I don't know how it goes down, but you know, I used to think that you pay for sex and then you get whatever kind of sex you want. But no, it's like, it's like itemized. There's level. It's like an a la carte. Like you either want, you want tomatoes, you want ketchup, or you just want the plain burger. And so that's what this guy is trying to say. He's trying to say, no, she signed up for this. She signed up for this and that's what she got. And then people will look at her Playboy thing and think, well, that's what she does. She shows her body. She offers her body for money. So how is she, you know, they think just because she posed in Playboy that she deserved whatever she got. And we all know from past episodes, when shit like that go down, man, Playboy don't know you. Playboy don't want anything to do with any negativity. That's pretty much what Tannenbaum and Holly Madison is saying.
Playboy probably would have tried to distance themselves from this situation and just not comment on it at all.
They don't want any connection to that. And Playboy was really strict about if there was any trouble, that was it. You were sent away. You weren't getting any pictorials. You weren't getting any work. You were considered a liability. And that's what happened to Melanie. But anytime something happened to a woman, it was talked about amongst all of the people in the mansion. And it was well known and documented in the press. And she was a casualty. And everyone talked about it and how terrible it was.
The press had printed stories that kind of blamed the victim. They were printing headlines that she must have been complicit somehow. We've heard this before, that she must have asked for this.
If everybody else knew what goes down at this Ocean Castle, how she didn't know? And I want to give her the benefit of the doubt and say she was naive, because she actually took her portfolio. So maybe she didn't know what went down. Because, you know what? That's true. Because a lot of times, only deviants know what happened in deviant locale. So maybe she didn't know what went down at this place. And she just heard this dude was an industry. She thought, oh, Hugh Hefner. Well, obviously he's on the up and up. He got magazines published. He's not a fucking deviant. And he was the most corporate deviant of them all. Just like the Weinsteins, just like the Cosbys, just like the Diddys, just like the Epsteins, just like all these fucking deviants. All the deviants, all the men with money and power and think they can do whatever the fuck they want. A lot of times, man, these young women, these youngsters, young women and men, a lot of times they've been sheltered from all that info, so they don't really know. And they can be totally innocent going to these events and these parties, thinking shit is sweet, thinking they're just going to, take my portfolio and show them what I got to offer, take my reel and show them my video. And they're like, I don't give a fuck about that. You gonna suck this dick? All right, well, you got the job. That's the only thing that matters. And that could be the only thing that matters.
I think that we who are alive and well in the post-Me Too era may have a little difficulty reaching back 20, 30, 40 years ago when women like Millie Heller were viewed as being sluts, prostitutes. They dressed provocatively. They came on to these men. But there is an awareness now that people like Melanie Heller were speaking the truth.
The detective is saying that, you know, the fact that she was at this party, the fact that she was at this place that's known for having freak shows sort of made her implicit in her own whatever happened to her. You know what I mean? And so they're saying she was complicit until a fight broke out. So the DA did not want to pursue a rape charge. So in the end, Bob McKeach was convicted of sexual assault, but he only served 30 days in jail. 30 days. That's all he got. Roy Radin was not convicted of sexual assault. Radin was convicted of possession of an illegal firearm. They wanted that revolver and cocaine and LSD. So he was convicted of drugs and a firearm. Guess what his fine was? $1,000 fine. That's it. That's all he got. $1,000 fine. The good thing about this is that because Radin had pretty much called in all his markers with this scandal, that he had no more markers called in. So that was his, you know, he was protected, yeah, but that was also his demise. So the cops didn't want anything else to do with him. They distanced himself from him. He had no more fucking protection because what he was providing was no longer more valuable than to have these cops protection. So he was completely done. That was his career was done. So he ended up leaving New York, and you know he went to Hollywood and tried to break into the movies. And so he ended up coming across this woman who was married to a major cocaine trafficker. She didn't like Radin at all. For some reason, they were in the same circle. She didn't like Radin. And she gave the order because I guess she had the power to. And we see this reenactment of Roy Radin getting two to the dome. And that was it. All right. So karma caught up with that motherfucker.
These stories all end the same way. You put out bad karma and it usually comes back to bite you on the butt or kill you.
Today, Melanie has taken herself out of the public eye and lives privately. I can certainly understand her choice to do so after everything she went through in the entertainment industry.
You have a young, innocent woman doing the right things for her career. She has aspiration, hopes, dreams. Her career would never recover from the incident. The two parties responsible for this crime were barely given a slap on the wrist.
I just don't know why no one warned her. I do not believe justice was served. Melanie was an up-and-coming, brilliant little actress who had it all going on, losing in the court system, and not feeling like she had anyone to support her. I think it just made her disappear from everything.
As long as there is an entertainment industry, and there's a young woman out there who wants to be a star, and there's a young man who wants to be a mogul and exercise his right to be a full-blown hedonist without impunity, this story's never going to end.
And that's going to do it for this episode. Send all your questions and comments and recommendations for a documentary that you want to see featured on this podcast to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.